Rebecca, in for Robin Young, it's here and now. It's being called an historic moment in Washington that some say could result in the most significant immigration policy change in decades. But it could be one that no one will end up completely satisfied with when and if Congress passes an immigration reform bill. The compromise agreement unveiled by the White House and a bipartisan group of lawmakers is already drawing criticism from both sides of the aisle and both sides of the immigration debate. The measure would provide a path to citizenship for some 12 million undocumented immigrants by setting up a process that could take up to 13 years and would require undocumented immigrants to spend thousands of dollars. Some conservatives deride the bill as an amnesty program. Some liberals say it's unworkable. Well, it is a complicated piece of legislation, and joining us to sift through it is Gail Chadwick. She's senior congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, first off, why is this bill drawing criticism from all sides?
Because it is a genuine compromise. It takes positions that are strung all the way across the political map and finds the best central tendency they thought they could. It was a long haul. I remember talking to some very weary-looking staff yesterday as they walked out of the announcement, and one of them said to me, "Well, now we're all piñatas for our own groups," meaning they did the best they could, but no one got all they wanted out of this bill. And what is interesting to me is watching how the jockeying is already beginning to change the bill, first on the floor of the Senate next week, then on the floor of the House in July, and finally in conference. As one group told me, we have three bites at this apple, and we're starting next week.
Let's go through the bill a little bit, Gail. What are the steps, essentially, the big steps first, that illegal immigrants would have to go through to get citizenship?
Well, the heart of this deal is a two-phased system. The first phase is enforcement, doubling the border control, doubling interior enforcement, new fencing, new security perimeters, 18,000 more border patrol, 200 miles of vehicle barriers, radar, camera towers, and so forth.
Well, wouldn't that take a long time?
Yes, it certainly could, and that's where you see the fraying of the deal already in evidence. There are people who are going to insist that every vehicle barrier be up there before the next phase of the plan can begin. However, there are elements that kick in immediately. For example, anyone who's here in the country who arrived before January 1st, 2007, who's here illegally, can register before all these trigger mechanisms kick in. Register, they'll be given a work authorization immediately, and then can be granted a visa and be on a path to permanent residence. That, I think, is the most sweeping aspect of this reform and the most difficult to work out.
Now, when I hear some of these provisions, a $5,000 fee, I have to register, some would be required to return to their home countries first, there are an awful lot of steps. What incentive, I mean, I know it's an incentive to be legal, but what is there? Are there other incentives to try to get people to go through this process to become legal?
I think the big incentive will be if the country does move toward a secure ID system, cards that cannot be forged. It's going to make it much harder to be employed. If employer sanctions, also an element of this bill, turn out to be real, then there would be pressure to register just because the jobs are not as available. That is what the conservative negotiators, that's why they signed on to a legalization plan, because they're convinced that it also includes a form of employer and sanctions and enforcement that may actually work this time. That would be a reason to, if you're illegal, to sign on. Also, I think the perception that this is a historic opportunity. I think one of the real concerns was suggested by Secretary Chernoff, who was also at the briefing yesterday, when he said, look, if you're not already in the country and you hear about this plan, do not cross the border immediately. That would be the dumbest thing you could possibly do. However, you could ask the question, why would that be dumb? Wouldn't this be a historic opportunity for you, too, if you could forge documents suggesting that you had been here 5 months ago?
Where do you think the bill stands in the Senate, and what do its prospects look like in the House?
I think its prospects in the Senate are actually very good. There is a strong bipartisan coalition represented. This deal was cut in the Senate. But I think the House picture is very different. House Democratic leaders repeated yesterday that if the White House can not deliver 60 to 70 Republican votes in the House, they think that this bill is going nowhere. That's a very tall order. This is a president who has been in favor of immigration reform ever since he came to the White House. This could be the single accomplishment of his second term. He had cabinet officials working personally here on this bill. This is a key issue for Republican primary voters, amnesty. It's a big risk for Republicans, especially in conservative districts, to support this bill. So we'll see how much sway the White House has with those Republicans. I expect that it will pass the Senate, have a much more difficult time in the House.
Gail Chadwick, senior congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
So how could the proposed legislation affect undocumented immigrants? For one view, we turn to Rigoberto Mancera, who's been living in the U.S. illegally since 1994. He's originally from Mexico City, and he works as a safety manager at a construction company in Phoenix, Arizona. Rigoberto came to the attention of immigration authorities last year. He had returned to Mexico after his mother died, and while trying to cross the U.S. border on his way back, he was stopped and imprisoned for 3 months. He is now out on bond and awaiting trial. And Rigoberto, you're in this country right now. What's your legal status?
Right now, I am in process.
What does that mean?
I am working. I'm fighting for have a chance for a state in America.
So right now, you're trying to become legal.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. This legislation in Congress, would this help you become a legal citizen of the United States?
Absolutely. The process is better for me. This is the reason for I waiting for this reform. I working in the community for make information about the benefits for this reform right now.
This law would require that you return home first.
That's correct.
How would this affect your children? You have four children in school in Arizona right now?
That's correct. You know, the experience my kid have it last November, that's very, very sad. Because we are the family all the time, is working together. All the time we play and make the homework together. I am the head to my family. When these guys don't see me for around to the 90 days, my kids is so sad. My kids is come down in the grades in the school.
So when you're talking about November, that was when you were stopped at the border and you were imprisoned for 3 months, the 90 days.
That's correct.
So that's what you're trying to do right now, is get the papers for you to be able to stay here.
That's correct.
In this legislation, it says that in order to apply, folks like yourself would have to pay a $5,000 fine and then application fees. Would that be something that your family would be able to do?
It's really, really that's too much money for the family involved, for over three or four kids or six members to the family. So you see, that's around to the $30,000 for each family. So that's a lot of money.
This bill also outlines certain things that undocumented workers would have to meet to be able to stay in the United States. For example, if you had certain skills or certain levels of education, you would be more likely to be granted citizenship. Does that part of the legislation, do you agree with that?
Absolutely, because I am in chemistry engineering. I have the master degree in chemistry petroleum. So really, for me and my wife, it's a good opportunity because Paul is finished the college in Mexico City. When I stay here for English college and I start to check, my family have a better life here. We have a chance for live in better situation, and this is the reason for keep growing here in Phoenix, Arizona.
Overall, Rigoberto, I would say that you have a lot of hope about this bill in Congress.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you. Rigoberto Mancera has been living in the United States illegally since he came here from Mexico City in 1994. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We now go to Glenn Spencer. He lives near the U.S.-Mexico border in Arizona. Glenn founded the group the American Border Patrol 5 years ago. It's a nonprofit that monitors the border by taking high-resolution photos and videos. The group even has a deal with the Federal Aviation Administration to take aerial shots of the border. Glenn, you've said that this legislation is a disaster. You say it'll weaken border security. But there are some provisions, I thought, to boost the number of border agents by, 6,000 people, to build a 200-mile vehicle barrier, 370 miles of fencing. So, what are your big concerns about this legislation?
I understand that the day that the bill is signed by the President of the United States, everyone in the country illegally is given a legal status, not necessarily a path to citizenship. Then they will say, well, they'll build the border fence and we'll do these other things. But they will be on a path to citizenship once the bill is signed.
Mm-hmm.
We have a bill. We have a Secure Fence Act of 2006 that was passed by 67% of the House of Representatives, 81% of the Senate, and signed by the President last October. Calls for a fence of 700 miles to be built in 18 months. How much of that fence have they built in the first 7 months? Nothing. As a matter of fact, as we just proved by flying the border last Thursday, all construction has been halted on the border.
Hmm. So what you're saying then is that you don't think that these border security strengthening measures would be undertaken?
No, I don't. I believe what will happen is they'll set them on the path to citizenship, then they'll find reasons to delay and stall, and then they'll come back and add amendments, just as they have in the past. In 1986, they passed the Immigration Reform and Control Act. President Reagan signed it. He said it was one of his biggest mistakes. They said, we're going to grant amnesty, and then we're going to secure the border. They granted amnesty. They did not secure the border. 1996, they passed the immigration laws. They said they were going to crack down, but they had loopholes in them that kept the government from enforcing those laws. Now, 20 years later, they're coming back and saying, all right, we'll just start them on the road, but we'll make sure we're going to enforce that fence. We should not trust, based on their history, we should not trust the people in Washington to do what they say they're going to do. They have a 2006 Secure Fence Act. The citizens of the United States must demand that they implement that before any discussion is held regarding any amnesty or legalization process.
So what do you think should happen then to the undocumented workers who are right now in this country?
I think we should enforce the law. We should begin to maybe it'll take a long time, but it took a long time for these people to get here, to begin enforcing our laws at the work site, and especially beginning with at the border, because we can do that. Here's the law, here's the line. What's the problem? This is what we have said. It's a simple matter for them to do this. They passed the law last year, and it's given Secretary Chertoff 18 months to build that fence. He hasn't done anything. In fact, he stopped everything. How can we trust this government to do what they say they are going to do when they refuse to enforce the law?
Glenn Spencer, founder of the American Border Control, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Just ahead, what happens to the World Bank with the resignation of Paul Wolfowitz? And later in the show, a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel and critic of the Iraq War reflects on the death of his soldier son in Iraq. It's Here and Now. Deborah Becker, it's Here and Now. Well, the saga of World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz is coming to a close. The White House says it'll move quickly to name a successor to Wolfowitz, who resigned after a scandal involving the financial package awarded to his girlfriend, a World Bank employee. Wolfowitz's departure in June will mark the end of his controversial 2-year tenure. His appointment by President Bush was a source of international scorn, with his previous job experience limited to defense and foreign policy. Despite his resignation, Wolfowitz has not admitted to any wrongdoing. Harvard University economics professor and Brookings Institution fellow Kenneth Rogoff joins us now. Welcome, Professor.
Pleasure to be here.
What does it mean that Paul Wolfowitz has resigned without really admitting any guilt and saying that he acted ethically and in good faith?
I wouldn't put a lot of weight on the, final document. I mean, the fact is that he was fired. There was a internal board document that, if push came to shove, the whole board was ready to back. which accused him of bad governance, to say the least. They were trying to get him out of there as fast as possible, and he'd been hanging on forever, and it was really hurting the bank.
Right, and the Bush administration had been hanging on as well until earlier this week, really, supported Wolfowitz, and then came out saying, well, you know, maybe we better start looking elsewhere. What caused that shift at the White House, do you think?
Well, it's very simple. If you're talking about a domestic position, just say the U.S. Attorney General, to pick a random example, it's very, very hard for anybody to dismiss him except the president. At the World Bank, the U.S. does not own this position. The U.S. has only 17% of the vote at the World Bank. So although there's an anachronistic tradition of having the U.S. appoint the World Bank president, it doesn't have any, you know, legal power, and there was no way that Bush could ultimately stop the rest of the world from forcing Wolfowitz out.
Now you have suggested in your writing that the World Bank president should not be appointed unilaterally by the U.S. Do you think that may change because of this?
I really do. I mean, I don't know that we're going to see it at this juncture. What we're likely to see is have President Bush nominate a credible candidate to replace Wolfowitz to fill out the rest of his term, while at the same time the bank puts in place a new system that opens things up. It's true that it's not going to be easy to break the logjam because the Europeans right now get the International Monetary Fund and the U.S. gets the World Bank. This is so anachronistic. It's so damaging to the two institutions. It made sense when they were formed 60 years ago in the ashes of World War II. But today, with Asia representing 40% of the world, with the developing world growing, it's just an incredible anachronism, and it almost makes them a laughing stock in some quarters.
So when you talk about credibility, what do you think this this situation with Mr. Wolfowitz has done to the credibility of the World Bank as an institution?
Well, Mr. Chavez in Venezuela is having a wonderful time with it. He's withdrawing from both the World Bank and the IMF, pointing to how corrupt they are. But I do think they can come out of it stronger in the end if they finally settle this issue of, you know, having a more open, transparent system, which is, it's really been a festering issue. So it really depends on what happens next.
Do you think that this situation with Mr. Wolfowitz, well, he certainly, you know, made some controversial decisions while he was at the World Bank. How much of the response to what he did was because of his background, because of his defense background, really, and the international controversy that his appointment to the World Bank started in the first place?
Well, I think that was certainly part of the problem. But, you know, you come to this job as a world leader, and you bring with you the baggage of your history. And it was an extraordinarily poor appointment in the first place. First, because it was already clear that, you know, being the architect of the Iraq War was not going to make you an international hero. And also, Mr. Wolfowitz had very little background for this job. No experience in development, no experience in finance, and that's what the World Bank does. You know, he's a brilliant man, but it's hard for anyone to hit the ground running when they're such an ill fit for the job.
Aside from choosing the head of the World Bank, do you think that other reforms might occur because of this within the World Bank?
That's the really sad thing, is that the World Bank needs reform. The World Bank's based on making loans instead of giving grants. So it gives poor countries loans, which it makes them pay back. It's just an incredible anachronism. Nobody needs a lending institution in today's world of very deep and liquid international capital markets. This was conceived after World War II, when Europe didn't even have domestic capital markets. But now it's just nuts. And ironically, the Bush administration had largely embraced this idea, and had they appointed someone else who had a deeper knowledge of the institution, we might have seen progress on it. I'm afraid that this whole imbroglio is going to set back the cause of reform in the World Bank for a long time because there already wasn't a consensus, and now they're just going to be, you know, swimming over trying to get how to appoint the president.
Some of the names mentioned as possible successors, already names have surfaced. Former Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick, Treasury Department number two man Robert Kimmett. Who do you think we'll see as a successor? Do you think that we'll have to sort of reach outside of the realm of folks in the U.S. To establish more credibility here?
You know, the two names you said, I think, are okay, but pretty unexciting. I think in this situation, it's important to pick someone who's really a global player and has really strong global credibility. I think it really should be a non-American right away. Trevor Manuel, the South African finance minister, who was on headed the World Bank Oversight Committee for several years. He'd be terrific. And I think there's some other good choices from developing countries. You know, one of my favorite choices is Gordon Brown. Unfortunately, he's going to become Prime Minister of England.
Kenneth Rogoff, economics professor at Harvard University and fellow at the Brookings Institution, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Next week on Here and Now, tainted pet food, contaminated spinach, who's watching the safety of our food? And arsonists or terrorists, a judge will decide the fate of 10 radical environmentalists for their acts of sabotage. It's Here and Now. Support for Here and Now. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. U.S. forces battled dozens of suspected insurgents in a city north of Baghdad today. The Iraqi army says the fight was triggered when militants attacked a coalition base in Bakuba. At least six insurgents were killed. This as the massive search continues for three missing U.S. soldiers believed to have been kidnapped by al-Qaeda-linked insurgents last weekend. Also today, ABC News says two of its Iraqi employees are dead after an ambush. The network says they were killed by a roadside bomb yesterday as the two men drove home from the network's bureau in Baghdad. Well, the war in Iraq is also hitting close to home this week for a frequent guest on Here and Now.
We did not encourage him to join the army. We didn't discourage him from joining the army. It was something that he had wanted to do.
That's Boston University International Relations Professor Andrew Basevich talking about his son Andy, who was killed by a suicide bomber north of Baghdad this past Sunday on Mother's Day. Andy was 27 years old and was serving as a first lieutenant in the Army. The elder Basevich is a retired lieutenant Army colonel who served in Vietnam and who's been on this program several times speaking out against the war in Iraq. He publicly talked about his son's death for the first time with Here and Now's Fred Tice, and Fred joins us in the studio. Welcome, Fred.
Hi, Deb.
Can you tell us how this conversation with Andrew Basevich, the elder Andrew Basevich, came about?
I was talking to his Andrew Basevich's three daughters, Andy's three sisters, earlier this week. And after that, I called their father, and he said he'd be willing to talk to me. So I went to the Basevich home yesterday, and we spoke for about half an hour in their screen porch.
It must have been really hard for him.
It was really difficult for him to talk about Andy. I asked him how he would want people to remember his son, and the question surprised him, he said, because how often does a parent even have to think about how people should remember their child. But I also wondered if it was even tougher in this case to deal with this because he's been so outspoken about the war in Iraq and now he's lost his only son to that war. Let's listen to what he had to say.
I have been an ardent critic of this war from any number of points of view. And the thought I never shared with Andy, because I didn't want to burden him with it, was that there's an ironic kinship that he and I have in terms of our military service. I went to Vietnam in 1970, served from 1970 to 71, when it was clear that the war was not going to be won and was probably headed toward some dismal conclusion. And my son goes to Iraq in 2006 when, at least it's apparent to me, not that I have any crystal ball, but it's apparent to me that this war is not going to be won and is probably headed for some dismal conclusion. So our kinship is that we, he and I, had a knack for picking the wrong war in which to serve.
Fred, do you think that Andrew Bacevich feels, I don't know, maybe in some way responsible for his son's death?
He told me he's struggling with that question. He told me he was enormously proud of Andy, proud because he didn't join the Army as what he called a pampered college kid, but joined as a private after he'd graduated from college and then went to officer candidate school and became a first lieutenant. And Andrew Bacevich was very proud that his son was serving in the same branch of the service, the armored branch that he did. But he also said he felt a responsibility to speak out on the war.
I thought that my responsibility as a citizen was to try to give voice to my concerns about U.S. foreign policy, generally about the war more narrowly. That, not that my voice mattered, but that if I spoke and I wrote in conjunction with the many, many others who write letters to the editors or write op-eds or who organize protests, who sign petitions, that somehow this democratic action would, in the end, make a difference. And yet it becomes clear now that none of that makes a difference. And so at the end of the day, you ask yourself, and this is, again, trying to figure out my own responsibility here, what kind of democracy is this when the people do speak and the people's voice is unambiguous, but nothing happens?
Fred, we know that when Andrew Bacevich was a guest on this program on Here and Now, he did not want to talk about his son's service on the air. But did he and Andy talk about the war very much, especially about the elder Bacevich's criticism of the war?
No. Actually, they didn't talk about the war. Andrew Bacevich said his son knew where he stood, but he told me he didn't want to burden him with the political controversy.
I mean, all of our soldiers in Iraq and in Afghanistan and wherever carry a tremendously heavy burden getting through the day, you know, accomplishing their missions, doing the right thing in enormously difficult circumstances. And I think it's inappropriate to then saddle them with all the swirl of political controversy that they can't affect anyway. So we tended not to talk about politics. So I sent him, I tried to send him an email every day, and I would tell him about us, you know, what were we doing. What do we hear from family, you know, and let him know that, there was a home to come back to that was waiting for him.
That's Andrew Bacevich talking about his son Andy, who was killed in Iraq on Mother's Day. He spoke with Here and Now's Fred Tice. Fred, thanks for sharing some of that conversation with us.
Thank you, Deb.
Funeral services for Army First Lieutenant Andrew Bacevich are scheduled for Monday. He is one of 3,400 members of the U.S. military who have been killed in Iraq since the war began in 2003. You're listening to Here and Now. How often have you heard things like carrots can improve your eyesight or eating celery actually burns calories? Well, there are a lot of myths about food and eating. And Dr. Paul Dawson, professor of food science and nutrition at Clemson University, and his students have put some common food myths under the microscope. They've asked, how bad is it to drink from the milk carton? Does double dipping really transmit germs? And is the 5-second rule true? And he joins us to talk about food fact versus fiction. Welcome, Dr. Dawson.
Hello, how are you?
Okay. Your team has tested a lot of commonly held beliefs about food, like hand washing and drinking out of the milk carton, and a big one in my house, the 5-second rule. Can you explain to listeners exactly what it is?
Yeah, there's a, like you said, a myth that if you drop something on a surface, the floor or a table that's dirty or whatever, if you pick it up quickly enough, that the food's still safe to eat, and that the bacteria or virus or whatever is not moved from the surface to the food.
And essentially what you did is you used salmonella and you put it on different surfaces, right? Tile?
Right. We sterilized surfaces like ceramic tile, laminated wood like you might have on a floor, and then even a typical Berber carpet. And then we would inoculate those sterile surfaces with salmonella, a known amount, and then drop food on it and then pick up food at different times to see if there was a difference in the exposure time and the transfer of bacteria.
When we're talking about salmonella on these surfaces, this is like significant bacteria, though, right? Or would it be a normal amount of bacteria that you might find in everyday life?
Well, we in our control study, inoculated with a lot of bacteria. May not normally find that on a floor, but you might find on the surface that had been previously exposed to raw food product, which routinely happens in kitchens and so forth. And we intentionally chose a bacteria that is of significance as far as food poisoning.
So how did the 5-second rule hold up?
Well, the 5-second rule did not hold up. Bacteria was transferred very quickly within 5 seconds to the food. In 30 seconds, there was very little difference. So picking it up very quickly had very little advantage. And then the surfaces were slightly had an effect. The carpet actually had a lower transfer rate than did tile. But from a practical standpoint, there was still significant transfer of bacteria.
So it didn't matter if it was 5 seconds or a minute?
Didn't make any difference.
And that transfer, is that still enough bacteria, even in that amount of time, to make someone sick?
Yeah, that's a good question. It depends on the bacteria. The typical salmonella, a healthy person takes a lot of cells, or consumption of a lot of cells to make you sick. But there are different bacteria like E. coli 01587 and some other bacteria that are very virulent, and so very few cells could make you sick. It's just a question of what's there.
They stay around for a while, too. Your study found, right, that some of these bacteria are around for a very long time, so even if you may think that a surface, say, is clean, you better be careful.
That's exactly right, and that was one of the things as our students, we got into this study. There's a lot of variables. Like you said, if I come in and make a surface dirty by handling raw food and walk away, and then you come in tomorrow and make a sandwich on that same surface, what was the effect? And we actually found out that salmonella in the levels we inoculated on a dry surface would last for 28 days. There was some there that could be transferred almost a month later.
I understand that you're also working on now double dipping.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun here. Clemson. this semester, we just finished up a study where we set up our treatments, and that is either biting a cracker and dipping it or just dipping it without biting it, and see if there was a difference in the amount of bacteria that appeared in the dipping solution. And it turns out there was a significant amount, over 3,000 cells in the double dipped chip, if you will, and less than 10 cells in the chips that weren't bitten. So that was a significant difference. I was kind of surprised at that result.
Yuck.
And I guess the take-home message from that is, if someone is carrying a cold, whatever, certainly that will be transferred probably to the dip.
So it would seem, from these experiments anyway, that you're finding that, you know, there may be some truth to a lot of these myths.
Exactly, yeah. The double dipping, yeah, and the drinking from the milk carton, we did that, and we kind of test those habits and really find out that oftentimes you're right, that the myth does hold up, or the practice is not a good one.
Dr. Dawson, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Paul Dawson is a professor of food science and nutrition at Clemson University. Just ahead, author Lionel Shriver. It's Here and Now. ¶¶ Whitaker, it's here and now. While we all may know that the choices we make define us, what about the choices we didn't make? How would we be defined if we had made the other choice? Well, that's a question writer and author Lionel Shriver takes up in her new book, The Post-Birthday World. The book is about a woman, Irina, who finds herself attracted to a man, Ramsey, while she's in a long-term committed relationship with another man, Lawrence. Ramsey is everything Lawrence is not. He's flamboyant, reckless, and passionate, while Lawrence is predictable, solid, and to Irina, at least, maybe a little boring. The book examines what would happen to Irina if she stays with Lawrence and what would happen if she goes with Ramsey. And Lionel Shriver joins us in the studio to talk about her new book. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
The book, as we said, writes both scenarios here for Irina, which man she will choose, but you write them simultaneously. Each chapter is the alternating story. Why did you choose to do it like that?
Well, I wanted to examine what the implications are for whom we love. And in using this structure that I did, I'm able to parse what the consequences are for one person as to which man she chooses in her life. And I wanted to look at both the big picture, that is, the major events in her life and how they turned out, what happened to her career, for example, but also the little ones. That meant telling the story side by side was especially useful.
So did you write this from personal experience, from maybe agonizing over a choice you didn't make or did make?
The book does spring from my having, a few years ago, been in the position, you could call it a privileged position, of choosing between two very fine men in my life. It didn't feel privileged at the time. It was agonizing. Mm. And for a long time after I made the decision, the other road, the other man, and what my life would have been like had I taken that direction, was strangely real to me.
You know, if I had to guess which one that you maybe supported over the other, and I would just guess because obviously the book leaves it as an open question, I would say Ramsey.
Well, yes, I married Ramsey.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Mm. But I have been pleased that so far the readership that I've heard from seems to divide pretty evenly between being Ramsey readers and Lawrence readers. In fact, I took a little bit of exception to your characterization in your introduction of Irina's feelings about Lawrence, that he was boring. I don't think that kind of relationship is boring, certainly when you're in it. I think maybe it seems dull from the outside because it's not characterized by big events and passionate arguments and erotic makeup sex. It's a kind of relationship that many people have and ultimately want.
I kind of thought, though, there was almost an attempt to maybe justify what Irina was doing because he was unaware. And I thought maybe she wasn't willing to examine some of those things about him, and maybe that's what the relationship needed.
Her dissatisfactions with Lawrence are not so much that he doesn't entertain her, but she needs more emotional output from him. They're not communicating. We're talking about a kind of relationship that many people begin to suffer. You don't exactly take each other for granted, but you do take the relationship for granted, which is something different. And you stop talking. You stop talking in that searching way that you do at the beginning of a relationship when you're trying to get to know each other. You fall back on the assumption that you do know each other already. And that's a dangerous assumption to make.
I'm wondering if you could read a part of the book about Irina's decision to go with Ramsey and what she had to say about that while Ramsey was actually very sick.
If I didn't kiss you over that snooker table, I'd never have known the highlights of my life. And it wasn't only that one kiss either. It was all the kisses. Those moments were worth, as you would say, the whole kit. The rows, the lonely nights with you in Bangkok, the fact that we suddenly don't have any money. I'm not sure I have the right to say it was worth hurting Lawrence's feelings so grievously. But it's only wised me up to think of myself in a less flattering way, as a normal, flawed, inconsistent woman instead of a saint.
So she's made peace, it sounds like, at least
yes.
In that story.
I think she makes her peace with her choice in each story, and that's part of the story, the bigger story. at the very end of the book, the novel throws back at the reader, well, what would you have done if you were leaning over that snooker table? Do you kiss this guy or not? Which man would you pick? And as I said, the readership will often divide off as to what the answer is. But I think either answer is fine, and either answer has its tragic element.
What would you say you learned most from writing this book, as you looked back on your own choices?
I suppose I came to understand on a gut level, in addition to an academic level, that whom we choose to love has a downside regardless of which person you select, that there is going to be a price to pay regardless of whom you choose, and maybe the most important thing to do is simply to choose someone. And that crossroads that I experienced in my own life, the main thing was that I went one direction or the other, and that to the best of my ability, I will continue to go in that direction and not so much second-guess myself. Oh, did I make the right decision? You stick with somebody, and that has a value of its own, and they're not going to be perfect, and they're going to have their dissatisfactions with you as well, and you make your peace with that.
When folks have written reviews about the book, one thing that they have said about Irina, and I want to ask you about it, is that she seems to be very focused, maybe too focused in some people's opinions, on the men in her life and not her own life. What do you say to people who have said that they think that that's maybe not a great characterization of a woman right now?
I don't think there's anything wrong with knowing about yourself that what will make more difference to your personal happiness is a successful relationship than anything else. There are plenty of people out there who do feel, frankly, and I don't think this is only women, I think it's men too, that they want a successful relationship, call it a marriage if you like, a good marriage, more than anything. After all, everyone doesn't have fascinating careers. Sometimes you're going to be working in a Walmart. You're going to tell me that it's really working in the Walmart that's going to make the difference as to whether you're happy, you know, whether you get to be head cashier. I don't think so. I think most people live in the domestic sphere emotionally, and that's where they're going to find their most satisfaction. I find it historically fascinating that to have a character who mostly wants to find true love is now considered shameful or lowly, especially if she's female.
Well, Lionel Shriver, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Did you ever have to make up your mind and pick up on one and leave the other behind? It's not often easy and not often kind. Did you ever have to make up your mind? Did you ever have to finally decide and say yes to one and let the one ride? There's so many changes and tears you must hide. Did you ever have to finally decide?
Lionel Shriver's novel is The Post-Birthday World, and that's the Love and Spoonful, asking the musical question, did you ever have to make up your mind? Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young returns Monday. Have a great weekend, and please join us again, Here and Now.
Make up your mind and pick up on one and leave the other behind. It's not often easy and not often kind. Did you ever have to make up your mind?
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.